The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on the 6th of March and written by Emily McFarlane Miller, entitled, Frank Griswold, Who Led Episcopal Church Through Tumultuous Times, Dies at 85. Bishop Frank Tracy Griswold III, who led the Episcopal Church through a tumultuous debate over the place of women and LGBTQ clergy and the denomination in the late 1990s and early 2000s, died on March the 5th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at age 85. Griswold served as presiding bishop of the mainline denomination as it saw the ordination of its first openly gay bishop in 2003, which increased pressure on some conservative dioceses to schism. His daughter, Eliza Griswold, a journalist for The New Yorker magazine, shared the news of her father's death on Twitter, describing him not only as beloved dad, but as a revered preacher and teacher and very funny human being with a boundless heart, as he believed God's is. Bishop Griswold was elected the 25th presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in 1997 and took his seat at the Washington National Cathedral in January 1998. The first presiding bishop to serve a 9-year term after the denomination's ruling body had reduced the length of the term from 12 years. His time in office ended in November 2006. A Religion News Service article described the Episcopal Church at the start of his tenure as one of the nation's most prestigious but chaos-wracked denominations. Scarred in recent years by financial and sexual scandals and still bitterly, perhaps irreparably, divided over the ordination of women as priests and the role of gays in church life. Upon becoming presiding bishop, he was immediately faced with threats of schism from several dioceses that refused to recognize women's ordination as priest, with some conservative Episcopalians taking legal control of the name and the flag of the church, even as they severed relations with the denomination. Before leaving the Diocese of Chicago to lead the denomination, he told reporters he spent time in a private prayer retreat. By virtue of the office of presiding bishop, I'm going to become a center of controversy, like it or not, and probably in some people's minds, I'm not going to be a human being. I'm simply going to be a living issue, he said. Undaunted, Griswold presided over the ordination and consecration of New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson, the denomination's first openly gay priest to be elected bishop, answering objections during the service with the words, "We're learning to live the mystery of communion at a deeper level." Robinson, who said he was receiving daily death threats at the time, told Religion News Service he later learned that the presiding bishop, like himself, had been wearing a bulletproof vest under his robes during the service. "That's how dangerous those times were," he said. The former bishop of New Hampshire said he's been thinking of Griswold since he learned of his passing and remembering how brave he was. He could easily have avoided presiding at that service of ordination to be a bishop, and he didn't. And that was a remarkable thing on several levels, he said. Griswold's participation communicated that the Episcopal Church's welcome to LGBTQ people went to the very top, Robinson added, and there's almost no comparing it to anything. As presiding bishop, Griswold also stressed ecumenical and interfaith relations, including a Muslim leader, Suleiman S. Niang, president of the Interfaith Conference of Metropolitan Washington, and an advisor to the American Muslim Council, to speak during his installation service, believed to be the first time a Muslim had done so for any presiding bishop. He helped bring the Episcopal Church into full communion with Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Bishop Michael Curry, current presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, praised Griswold as a remarkable and faithful servant of God, as he asked for prayer for his predecessor's family and all who mourn his loss. The Washington National Cathedral remembered Griswold as a kind and gentle priest who held the church together despite enormous pressures from around the world. Through thoughtful and prayerful leadership, he expanded access to God's table for LGBTQ Christians and leaders, and helped establish a life-giving full communion agreement with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, reads a statement on the cathedral's website. When it would have been easier to say no, Bishop Griswold walked with God to find a way to say yes, and for that, we are very grateful. Born in 1937 in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, Griswold was descended from two previous bishops in the Episcopal Church. Bishop Alexander Vietz Griswold, the denomination's fifth presiding bishop, and Bishop Sheldon Munson Griswold, the missionary bishop of Salina and what is now the Diocese of Western Kansas, according to Episcopal News Service. He earned a bachelor's degree from Harvard College and a master's degree from Oriel College at the University of Oxford, according to a biography provided by his family that was shared by the Episcopal Church. Ordained in 1963, he served three parishes in the Diocese of Pennsylvania before he was elected the 10th Bishop of Chicago in 1987. Bishop Paula Clark of Chicago, who said she last spoke with Griswold before her ordination and consecration last year, remembered the former presiding bishop as enormously kind and supportive. Her predecessor, Bishop Jeffrey D. Lee, who served as the 12th Bishop of Chicago and is currently Bishop Provisional of the Episcopal Diocese of Milwaukee, called Griswold's death the passing of an era in the Episcopal Church. Frank's dignified, gracious manner and credentials allowed him to lead the church toward becoming safer and more welcoming for all of God's people. All of us who have continued that work in the last two decades are in his debt, Lee said. From 1998 to 2003, Griswold co-chaired the Roman Catholic Anglican Commission and made significant contributions to the denomination's 1979 Book of Common Prayer. He wrote a number of books, including Going Home, Praying Our Days, A Guide and Companion, and Tracking Down the Holy Ghost, Reflections on Love and Longing. In addition to his daughter Eliza, Griswold is survived by his wife Phoebe, daughter Hannah, and three grandchildren. Now an article that was published on March the 6th, written by Adele M. Banks, entitled Baptist Joint Committee Gains Faith and Justice Center, Grows Religious Liberty Work. The Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty is acquiring the Center for Faith, Justice, and Reconciliation in a move its leaders say will help them broaden efforts to support a more universal range of religion in the country. The 87-year-old coalition of 15 Baptist denominations, including both predominantly black and white Baptist organizations, is adding the fledgling center as part of its project for race and religious freedom that began in 2021. This opportunity for BJC to acquire the center and to continue this incredible work of reimagining religious freedom within the organizational home of BJC is a way for us to formalize this commitment to race and religious freedom and continue the work for many years to come, said Amanda Tyler, executive director of the BJC, in an interview with RNS in advance of the March 6th announcement. Sabrina E. Dent, who became president of the center in January 2022, has joined the BJC staff after previously serving there as a fellow, followed by roles as a program director at the Freedom Forum Institute's Religious Freedom Center and as a senior faith advisor at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The center began in 2019 when the 28-year-old Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond, the first freestanding seminary developed as an alternative to the Southern Baptist Convention's six seminaries, closed. Its trustees viewed the center as a way to continue the seminary's commitment to ecumenism and racial diversity. One of the things that we prioritized in our work was really reimagining religious freedom through the experiences of marginalized communities, whether it was racial or religious minorities, said Dent in an interview, citing how the think tank has hosted multi-day virtual conferences, bringing together scholars and policymakers to discuss issues such as housing, voting rights, and women's rights, as well as hour-long programs for the general public. Last year, the center also posted on its website a letter from a transgender youth to show its opposition to proposed Virginia policies that would limit the rights and safety of some children, noting the policy set a precedent for imbuing a specific ideal of religious belief, Christian nationalism, in the homes of non-Christians and minority Christians. Denton Tyler said, a key facet of the center's work will be to continue to address Christian nationalism, a topic Tyler and the BJC have been working on since 2019, when they started the grassroots campaign called Christians Against Christian Nationalism. We believe the best antidote to the poison of Christian nationalism is a commitment to the foundational values of religious freedom for all, said Tyler. And so, in order to confront Christian nationalism, we need the most robust understanding of religious freedom for all that we possibly can have. And the work of the center directly addresses that. Tyler said the BJC leaders felt challenged to diversify the committee's work after the 2015 mass shooting at Charleston's Mother Emanuel African Methodist Church. She also said her organization learned that in the 1940s, a Black Baptist board member's request that the BJC take a stand addressing racial injustice went unheeded, causing some Black denominational leaders to halt their attendance at board meetings. We as an organization have been on a journey of understanding that truth and confronting the truth that religious freedom has been white too long, and that we, even at BJC, have had too limited a view of our mission and how that has inhibited fulfillment of our mission, said Tyler. And we are in a season now of change and repair as we build a more inclusive organization and a more inclusive vision of religious freedom for all. Effective March the 13th, Tyler said, the center's activities will be part of BJC's programming. The center will formally end its corporate status later this year. The operations of the center, which previously were housed at a library at Union Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond, have already been moved to the BJC, with Dent being hired on February the 1st. Dent said board members, many of whom are former or current leaders at theological schools, will become advisors to the center when the transition is complete. Interim Dean Corey D.B. Walker of Wake Forest University School of Divinity, one of those board members, said he expects the new arrangement will lead to expanding work by the center that will include religious and secular people and Jewish and Muslim groups, as well as other Christian organizations. Theologically, it is recognizing that the Imago Dei, the image of God, is found in all people. It is found in all cultures, and religious freedom and this acquisition enables BJC to then extend that in new and significant ways, he said, and to ensure that understanding is not something that's ancillary. It is constitutive of how we continue to make a more just and humane world, consistent with the vision of the gospel. Now, an opinion piece published on the 7th of March and written by Karen Swallow Pryor, who is a research professor of Christianity and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. It is entitled, Replacing Vengeance with Mercy in Our Death Penalty Policy. Last week, attorneys for a man considered to be one of the most mentally ill prisoners in Texas history sought a stay of his execution, scheduled to take place on April the 5th. While the crimes Andre Thomas committed are horrific, his case is not a typical death penalty case. It is marked by failures for Thomas and for his victims from the beginning of Thomas's difficult life to its appointed end. In 2004, Thomas murdered and mutilated his estranged wife, Laura Boren, their son, Andre, and her infant daughter, Leah Hughes, before stabbing himself in the chest. When the attempt to kill himself failed, he turned himself into the police. He told authorities he had committed these acts in order to slay the demons that voices had told him were inside his loved ones. While in jail a few days later, he removed his own eye with his bare hand. Following his conviction in one of the killings, he removed his other eye in a similar fashion. Raised in extreme poverty by an alcoholic mother, Thomas has experienced hallucinations, delusions, and suicidal ideations from childhood until today. And his extreme mental illness can hardly be debated. At trial, Thomas was indeed determined to be schizophrenic, but the court invalidated his insanity defense, accepting the argument that his mental condition was caused by voluntary intoxication, in other words, his own fault. In October, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Thomas' claim that race bias played a part in his case's outcome. Thomas's situation is a tragic illustration of how, first, social support systems and then the legal system can fail the most mentally ill, and consequently those they hurt. What constitutes justice in a case when someone is suffering such extreme mental illness? What constitutes mercy when someone is so obviously in need of care? Help that, had it come earlier in his life, may have resulted in entirely different outcomes for so many people? These are the questions Thomas's case compels us to answer. If one measure of a society is its treatment of the most vulnerable, then that society should be especially judged by how it responds when those with mental illness commit heinous crimes. The death penalty has been ruled by the U.S. Supreme Court to be cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore a violation of the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, when the perpetrator lacks the ability to understand their actions, and therefore has less moral culpability. We automatically exempt those of subpar intellectual ability or offenders under a certain age. However, mental illness does not yet automatically protect someone from capital punishment. The Severe Mental Illness Initiative of the American Bar Association argues that those with either severe mental disabilities or illnesses should not be subject to the death penalty. The ABA states, this does not mean that defendants with mental illness should be absolved of responsibility for their crime. Rather, if found guilty, they would still be punished and could receive life in prison without parole, but would not be eligible for the death penalty. Seldom do justice and mercy take the same form, but some religious leaders and evangelical leaders are pleading for the state to be both just and merciful by giving to Andre Thomas the care he has needed all his life for the rest of his life. A letter from evangelical Christian leaders to Texas Governor Greg Abbott and the Texas Board of Pardon and Parole, signed by, among others, president of National Association of Evangelicals Walter Kim, author and activist Shane Claiborne, former vice president of community outreach for Focus on the Family, Kelly Rosati, author and activist Lisa Sharon Harper, and Whitworth University professor Aaron Griffith, urges officials not to execute Thomas, but instead to have him spend the remainder of his life in a secure psychiatric prison facility where he can receive the care he truly needs. Allowing Mr. Thomas to be executed in his permanently disabled, mentally incompetent, and vulnerable state, the letter states, would serve no useful purpose other than pure vengeance, which we believe is not something Christians can or should pursue. Not repaying evil for evil, Romans 12:17, and turning the other cheek, Matthew 5:39, mean breaking the cycle of violence. Historically, Americans have cited vengeance based on a misapplication of the Old Testament's proportionate justice principle of an eye for an eye as the overwhelming reason for their support for capital punishment, far above serving as justice or as a deterrent. Yet in recent years, Christians seem to be rethinking not only this justification of the death penalty, but also the punishment itself. While a majority of Americans, 60%, and even more Protestant Christians, 66%, continue to support capital punishment, that level of support has dropped as the numbers of executions nationwide continue to decline. One example of the shift in thinking is expressed by Christian ethicist Matthew Arbo in The Case Against the Death Penalty, in Cultural Engagement, A Crash Course in Contemporary Issues. Arbo acknowledges that while the Bible permits capital punishment, Jesus' instruction in the Gospel of Matthew 5:38-41 makes clear that retaliatory interpretations of the law are incorrect. Rather, Arbo argues, Jesus implores forbearance and charity, dismissing any reading of the Jewish law that justifies vengeance. If vengeance as a reason for the death penalty is removed from the equation, and the courts look more to factors of justice and deterrence, then it becomes clearer in a case with someone as mentally incapacitated as Andrew Thomas that both justice and deterrence might be better served by heeding the plea to give Thomas lifetime imprisonment and psychiatric care. As troubling and unique as the case of Andre Thomas is, it invites a closer examination of all the factors that play a part in death penalty cases. Justice for victims of all kinds, care for the sick and vulnerable, and mercy that fulfills not just the letter of the law, but the spirit, too. Our last piece is an excerpt of an article published on the 1st of March, written by Emily McFarlane Miller, and entitled, Meet the Organization Preserving and Promoting the Stories of Black Methodists. When most people think of the United Methodist Church, Carol Travis said, they don't picture black people. People still think that the United Methodist Church is white, said Travis. You don't see enough black faces, even though we have been there from the beginning. We never left. The African American Methodist Heritage Center, where Travis is executive assistant, aims to change that image. But after funding from the United Methodist Church General Conference ended and in-person events were put on hold during the COVID-19 pandemic, the AAMHC is looking for donations in order to continue its work, which includes recording oral histories and making its collection more widely available. We just want it so people will not forget that we've been there all along, and that we've made major contributions to the denomination and to the world at large, said Travis, who has been part of the AAMHC since its early days. In 1939, during what the United Methodist Church now calls a painful period of segregation, Methodists created a separate central jurisdiction for black congregations, alongside its geographical jurisdictions. When the Evangelical United Brethren Church and the Methodist Church merged to form the United Methodist Church in 1968, the central jurisdiction was disbanded. White Methodists dominated the pews, and Travis said there was a current concern that with the United Brethren, with the Methodist Church, with black folks coming back from central jurisdiction, that our story and our issues would be lost. That's when Black Methodists for Church Renewal, one of the five ethnic caucuses in the United Methodist Church, was founded. In 2001, the caucus created the African American Methodist Heritage Center to recover and remember Black Methodist contributions. Under the leadership of Bishop Forrest Stith, now retired, the center began collecting photos, records, papers from prominent Black Methodists, and other artifacts from congregations across the denomination. It also created videos about Black history within the denomination and led workshops across the country, training congregations to preserve their histories. We did a lot of good things, and we broke down our goals to be to preserve our rich history, to promote our rich history, to also do some research, and to ensure that local churches and other entities kept their history alive as well, Stith said. In recent years, the AAMHC also has been recording oral histories from Black leaders within the denomination, including bishops, their wives, and others who belong to the central jurisdiction. The organization is working with the denomination's General Commission on Archives and History to digitize and make them widely available. It also continues to encourage churches and individuals to send in any historic documents and records that they may have. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.